First of all, can I just say welcome on behalf of the Global Strategy Forum. Thank you for coming. This is our second lecture of the month. Last week we had Sir Chris Mantikelt talking about climate change and security implications. This week we have General Sir Mike Jackson who's going to speak. Before I introduce the General, could I just thank the Right Honourable John Speller, who's agreed to chair today's event and to provide a reply. First elected to Parliament in 1982 for Birmingham Northfield. Lost in 83, but returned in 92 as MP for Worley. He's held numerous positions in the government. Minister of State for the Department of Transport, Local Government and Regions, Minister of State, Department of Transport, Minister of State for Ministry of Defence, which is one of the reasons why I asked him here today, and also Parliament Undersecretary at the Ministry of Defence. The format that John will host is General Mike will speak, Q&A from the floor chaired by John Speller, and then he will wind up events with a reply. So today's speaker, General Sir Mike Jackson, has had an extraordinary distinguished military career spanning some 40 years, seen active service in Northern Ireland, Bosnia, Macedonia and Kosovo, has also worked across virtually the whole spectrum of the MOD, and also worked with many allied forces. Yeah. He's also commanded, amongst others, the 1st Battalion of the Parachute Regiment and 39 Infantry Brigade. I'm not going to list all the appointments because there are so many, and I'm sure you can read all about them in his book. But needless to say, it was a rapid rise through the system, culminating in his appointment as Chief of the General Defence Staff in February 2003, a post he held until August 2006. His memoirs, entitled Soldier, the Autobiography, were published this September. There are copies here on sale. General Mike will sign copies again after the event. He has signed some already. I'm sure he'll tell you it's a right riveting read, so form an orderly queue at the end. But I'll say no more. I'm going to hand over to General Mike Jackson, ask him to give his thoughts under the title of General Reflections. Thank you.
I'm sorry if it sounds a bit like a second-hand car salesman in front of you, but I have learnt, the first time I published a book, that if you don't tell people to buy it, they may not. So it's over there, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be around for a bit after 2 o'clock, delighted to sign the books. Only one careful owner, 9,000 miles on the clock, for you, Gov, special price. Now, I've got half an hour or so before we move into the question period to, I think, take some stock of where we are. When I say we, not necessarily just this country, but where this rather uncertain world is at the moment. And I need to go back a little bit just to get some compare and contrast into your minds. It is approaching 20 years since the end of the Cold War. It had an awful simplicity to it. It would have been awful had it gone hot. But it had something of a nature of simplicity, of uncomplicated issues at that point. Then it ends with the extraordinary sight of the Berlin Wall being demolished from the east side in November 1989. And you will recall that Francis Fukuyama wrote a book which he rather perhaps optimistically entitled The End of History. Well, he would, as a soldier might put it, now seem to be a bit previous with that title, because it doesn't seem to me that history has ended at all. Because what happened was that the analogy, if I can use it, of the pressure cooker, whereby some quite deep-seated, long-standing ethnic regional rivalries and hostilities had been kept inside the pressure cooker with the lid screwed down by the effect of the block-on-block strategic position of the Cold War. But then that lid came off, and we saw, with that release of pressure, these difficulties start almost immediately, not least in Europe's backyard, in the Balkans. And so that was quite a shift into a different sort of activity for the armed forces, of which more in a moment. So we had that extraordinary seismic shift in strategic circumstances. Then came the second. It will be debated as to how fundamental it is, I dare say, in due course as history gets written, but so-called 9/11. And I just note, as an extraordinary and bizarre paradox, 9/11, of course, to an American, is indeed the 11th of September. To a Brit, it's the 9th of November. That is the night the Berlin Wall came down, 9/11/11/9. It's bizarre. But here we had this second quite seismic shift in strategic circumstances, where, frankly, a gauntlet was thrown down in front of the West, but in particular in front of the United States, by Al-Qaeda and its perversion of a historic religion. And they made it clear, it seems to me, that the West, its values, its freedoms, its way of life, was absolutely inimical to those who carried out those attacks, and then subsequently, and we know of Madrid, we know of 7/7 in London. 7/7 is easy, of course, you can have that one which way round you like. And where are we now, then, in all of this? Well, it seems to me that if there was ever a certainty, which I would argue there probably wasn't, there certainly is no certainty in today's world. We do live in extremely uncertain, almost uncharted territory, where the old saw that expecting the unexpected is not a bad handrail here. It is difficult for me also to, in any sense, I think, forecast a safer world at some point in the future. There seems to be no evidence from which you can say, well, once we've got Iraq out of the way, once we've got Afghanistan out of the way, once we've achieved a settlement in the Middle East, as between Israel and Palestine, then perhaps it will be the end of history. I don't think I can go along with that. It doesn't seem like that to me. We have moved, in the nature of what we do, from a strategic position where, at least to some extent, the possession of territory, of terrain, was a dominant, or one of the dominant factors, to a position now where the battleground is not about which ideology sits on which bit of the planet. It may come to that, but right now, this is much more a battle of ideas, a battle of values, and a battle of how you see the world and the freedoms which may or may not go with your own position. That seems to me the terrain on which we are now engaged. And there are some other causes for concern, it seems to me, besides this ideological enmity which was so appallingly demonstrated on 9/11 and since. There are some other concerns. I'm not a green per se, and I read with huge interest David Bellamy's very interesting piece in Today's Times, where he questions the received wisdom of global warming. But what is clear, and what is, I think, absolutely factual, this planet makes no more coal, it makes no more oil, no more gas, indeed, no more uranium. And so the access in a world which is developing extremely fast in certain quarters, and where energy demand is increasing thereby exponentially, as India and China in particular continue this very rapid pace of industrialization, access to energy could be a source of conflict in the future. The distribution of water on this planet, that's fresh water as opposed to saline, is a little perverse. After the summer we've had, it may not be much of a concern in the United Kingdom. But it can be very much, I think, a concern where water is scarce and the politics in that region are difficult in any event. These could be causes of certainly regional conflict. The whole question of nuclear proliferation, I'm afraid I am not an optimist here. I cannot see that nuclear proliferation can be avoided. It's not a question really, I think, of if, it's a question of when and how best that can be handled, and it's a very difficult question. And perhaps my final thought about future concerns is the growing difference between industrialized or indeed post-industrial countries, those who are industrializing now so rapidly and with such huge growing incomes, and those parts of the world which are not. The so-called have-not gap is going to increase, and it's going to take, I think, great imagination to avoid this indeed also becoming more of a cause of conflict than arguably it is at the moment. Now, where we've got to in today is handling a number of counter-insurgency operations. My great friend General Rupert Smith published a book about 18 months ago which he entitled The Utility of Force. It's a demanding read, as those of you who have dipped into it will know, but it's Rupert's distillation of his own experiences and the extent to which military force actually has palpable value at the end. Now, he concludes that, in his phrase, that industrial war is a thing of the past, by which he means large armies maneuvering one against another with possession of terrain being what they're about, navies maneuvering one against another to establish sea control, air forces maneuvering against each other to establish, to fight for air superiority. He said this is over. What we're now engaged with is operations amongst the people. A phrase which is very vivid, because if you're with me when I say today's battleground is intellectual rather than physical terrain, then that's putting it in a different way. But my question is here, and Rupert and I debate this at great length, can you be certain that force on force, state on state, so-called industrial war, symmetrical, conventional, whatever word you want to use, is indeed a thing of the past never to recur again? Well, I don't think I can go all the way with my good friend and agree that it is. It will not happen again. There is no evidence to suppose that. We would hope it, that's a different matter, but there is no evidence that I can see from which you can deduce that industrial war is indeed at an end. Because were you so to deduce, you would come to some very radical conclusions indeed about what you would need in terms of size, shape and structure of armed forces. I shall return to that in a bit. Can I just get one thing out of the way? I still hear the odd siren voice saying, well, yes, I'm with you with all of that, but we really shouldn't, therefore, for Britain, we shouldn't be getting involved outside of these shores. We are fortunate enough to be an island, an offshore island of the European continent. Frankly, we can pull up the drawbridge and all these nastinesses can take place at thousands of miles away, and that'll be fine. I'm afraid to me that is not much better than the small boy pulling the duvet over his head and hoping the bogeyman will go away. I don't see it that way at all, particularly as we live in an increasingly globalized world. But a word or two, if I may, about intervention, because that is what we have been deployed upon really since the end of the Cold War in one way or another. And I'm going to start in an area perhaps which may not be in the forefront of your minds, but should not be forgotten. And that is, at midnight on the 31st of July last, the British Armed Forces went non-operational in Northern Ireland after 38 years, less a week or two. It was a notable achievement on all sides. But what I would ask you to think about here is, A, it took a very long time. B, the source of that conflict was not of itself military. The source of that conflict was political. You had two groups of people on the same quite small piece of territory who had quite differing views, opposing views, about who they were and who they wanted to be in the future. And there are many politicians in the audience, and you can come back at me in question time, but it seems to me that if indeed the root cause of this conflict or any other is political, then the outcome, the settlement, the solution must be of itself political. You cannot force, by using force, people to think differently to what they do. You can try and change their behavior, pro tem, but at the end of the day, putting together differing political positions can only be a matter of politics. It is the purpose, therefore, of the security forces, both police and armed forces, so to run the campaign as to allow that political settlement to emerge. And one hears a bit of sloppy talking about winning and losing. Winning in Northern Ireland was, to me, in a way, quite simple. Seen from a military point of view, was that what was not allowed to happen was that unlawful violence could change constitutional arrangements against the wishes of a majority of the people subject to that constitution. That, to me, is winning. And just bear that in mind, if you would, as I move on. The Balkans. Bosnia, I'm fairly confident about. Kosovo, I'm less confident. Certainly what happened in 1999 bought time, but it hasn't yet brought us a lasting and permanent solution with it. That, again, is a matter of politics, and they're very difficult ones. So I'm a little less sanguine where Kosovo is concerned. But let me turn to Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq. Yes, it's been messy. It hasn't been as anybody would have wished. But I think it's still too early, probably far too early, to call a judgment as to whether there was success in the long term, in strategic nature, or not. And you will no doubt want to come back to me in question time. But the politics are changing in Iraq, which is quite interesting to watch, because without pushing my analogy from Northern Ireland too hard, the fact that the Shia and Sunni, or some of them, have found it impossible not to use violence one against another in their struggle for power positions after the fall of Saddam Hussein is of itself political in nature. And again, the coalition cannot defeat in a military sense this or that faction. On the contrary, it's there to assist them to come together, I fervently hope, in a way which will solve the political rivalry. And we'll see how that one goes. En passant, just let me say that where the British Armed Forces are in the south, again, one has seen quite a lot of nonsense spoken about this. It is entirely within a strategy which is held for 3 years now, that as and when, on a province-by-province basis, by agreement between the coalition and the Iraqi government, that the Iraqi armed forces, security forces, in that area were now capable of taking on primary responsibility for security, there would be a handover. And this is what has happened in three of the four provinces in the south for which Britain had the lead responsibility. And what happened, what, 5-6 weeks ago was it, when there was a handover in Basra city between British forces and Iraqis. And I have little doubt, I don't know, but I would expect the remainder of Basra province to be handed over this side of the new year. We shall see. And so one can see a sort of endgame emerging for Iraq. How long we the coalition, and some people will say the US and the UK are coming at it in different ways. I wouldn't entirely agree. It's within the overall strategy. But the presence there is another matter. It may be some while. But it will be smaller than we are. And I think the announcement the other day was, what, 3,500, which is probably approaching the minimum sensible centre of gravity we should have. Iraq's a different... Afghanistan is a different matter. This will, I suspect, be a pretty long haul. We cannot, in my view, and when I say we, much of the debate in this country gets rather UK-centric and seen through a very UK prism, often seen through party political prism at that. Not terribly helpful because, of course, we are but one, an important one, but we are but one member of NATO, which is actually engaged in that operation. There is an argument that more could be done by certain other NATO members. Again, we could return to that in question time if you wish. But if we, NATO, the West, were to withdraw from Afghanistan, I have very little doubt in my own mind that the Taliban would overrun the duly elected, for the first time, I think, in Afghanistan's history, and elections which were deemed as pretty much fair and free by international observers, would overrun Karzai's government, that they would reimpose their version of government, so-called, with all its very unpleasant attributes. It would give safe haven to Al-Qaeda again. We would be back to square one, if not worse. This is something we have to see through for our long-term strategic security. There are some difficulties, of course, not the least of which is the whole question of poppy growing. It's gone off the radar screen a bit in Britain. It was on it. But we do have this very difficult conundrum. 80% of the heroin consumed in Britain, I'm advised, originates from the poppy fields of Afghanistan, mainly southern Afghanistan. It is also illegal to grow poppies under Afghani law. Equally well, to slash and burn a poppy field belonging to a peasant farmer is literally removing the food from his children's mouths. It wouldn't be a way to win hearts and minds, and that's a conundrum which needs, I think, more careful thought than has yet been given. But if I can now, having done that very quick tour d'horizon, just say a word or two about the purpose of intervention. Why do we do this? Again, it seems to me that this is straight out of Clausewitz. His great dictum, that war is politics by another means, seems to me to hold just as good today as it did when he wrote those words. Because the purpose of an intervention is, of course, political. It's not to go and defeat somebody's armed forces. It's not even to go and remove a repressive and brutal regime, per se. No, it goes much further. The strategic object must be a country which is at peace with itself, at peace with its neighbours. Probably, although for me, not necessarily in its same borders. With a representative government, not necessarily a Western liberal democracy, but a representative government with which the majority of the people at least feel comfortable. An economy which is starting to move. On the humanitarian side, the return of refugees. You probably also have had to demobilize a large number of fighters, perhaps after a civil war from both sides, with all the difficulties that incur. So that's what you're about. So that the country in which you have intervened moves from its ghastly and dark past into something of a better future. and behaves as a responsible member of that homogeneous body-ish, the international community. This is very easy to say. It is extremely complex, extremely challenging to actually put into effect. And it's by no means is it purely a matter for soldiers and indeed policemen. It is a matter for many strands of government here, who all have to come together to actually enable that result to come about. And none of us, I fear, when I say us, Western countries who are involved, are particularly good at bringing together the sinews of government to actually make it work. My analogy here is the strands of the rope. If you get those strands of the rope well woven, you get more strength from your strands than the sum of the parts. So, now, very briefly, as my time is beginning to run out, I would like just to have a look at, particularly where this country is concerned, where the armed forces are as one of the primary, not the, but one of the primary tools in achieving these political objectives. The first thing is, and it's a very big question indeed, let me go back to the nature of today's operations, counterinsurgency, asymmetric, unconventional, use whatever word you wish, non-industrial, to go back to Rupert. But the really big question is, if we are uncertain of tomorrow's world, if we are uncertain that we may not again perhaps have to fight a form of force-on-force war, then we must maintain the national insurance policy of a war-fighting capability. The argument, as ever, will be how big a premium from the national purse should that insurance policy carry with it. But there is a question here of the willingness of any democracy to foot a bill for defence, which in an ideal world would not have to be paid at all, and the money could go to some more worthy, as some people see it, causes. That is a political decision, it seems to me, of high strategic order. Because it's about balances. It's about spending today and spending for the future. It's about the balance between a possible necessity to fight and win a force-on-force war, as opposed to ongoing operations today, which are of a counterinsurgency nature. It's about a balance between what you spend on people and what you spend on equipment. There are no easy answers to any of these difficult judgments. What I do know at the moment is we struggle in this country, and I dare say others, perhaps with the exception of the United States, we struggle with the problem of the zero sum, by which I mean that if you wish to give Paul something more, you've got to take it away from Peter within a settled and pretty much static defence budget. Yes, I know the government will say it's been the longest years of increase in the defence budget since whenever. Frankly, I don't think it adds up. Defence inflation is always known to be, particularly where equipment's concerned, rather higher than general inflation. And 1.1, or whatever it is, so-called real increase, probably rubs out very quickly indeed. I would say it's no better than a flat line, and that's where we are from the recent comprehensive spending review. So, just a couple of numbers, just to remind you. We spend in this country, or I think the plans for next fiscal year are £34 billion, give or take. Sounds a great deal of money. It's just over 2% of GDP, and it's taken from total government spending of well over £600 billion. So I think once you get that in perspective, maybe a modest increase in the zero sum will avoid you having to rob Peter to pay Paul. Do you get value for money? Well, I believe you do. From the people, I think you get extraordinary value for money. I was talking yesterday to a young officer just back from 6 months in Helmand province in Afghanistan, who just said, our soldiers are awesome. 19, 20-year-olds, 50 degrees plus of heat, carrying a lot of kit, but just awesome, he said. And they're winning every tactical engagement they come against. And he said to me, and just to put another little, perhaps red herring, no, that's the wrong word, just a bit of a shibboleth to one side, he said, the kit is immaculate. Now, if that goes hard with some of you, I can only quote what he's saying to me. The kit is immaculate. But he also said, when chatting to a corporal, some people, of course, say, Afghanistan, we shouldn't be here. It didn't go well the last couple of times we were here. Ah, to which the corporal said, well, we're a different army now. And if I were them, I wouldn't be taking us on. Bad judgment. There we are. Anecdote, but for what it's worth. If I may, just finished. The most important thing, particularly where the army is concerned, is almost beyond money and almost beyond anything else, and that is the question of ethos. It is ethos which binds the army together. It's the superglue which holds soldiers together when the going is challenging and when the going is dangerous. And I would just urge, many of you are opinion formers, I would urge you, please, to always accentuate that point, that the army's ethos is, and it's peculiar in a way to the army, because the army is peculiar. There isn't another army in this country. It is a monopoly. And I think, dare I say it, we know best how to put that together. And I think the results bear it out. Yes, there has been, I think, a welcome reopening of a debate about the so-called military covenant. We do ask young soldiers to go to difficult and dangerous places, to take the risk, if need be, at the risk of their life. The other side of the equation is that their conditions of service and their accommodation are decent. Not luxurious, but decent and fair. It's as simple as that, and we're not getting it right in some areas. So, there we are. I think I've just about said enough, but I will share with you, if I may, another little anecdote, this time personal with me. And it's, I take you back three and a half years to early March, mid-March, 2003. It's the desert in northern Kuwait. 1st Armored Division is there, training very hard, with the almost certain knowledge of what they're going to be required to do. And I was talking to a young soldier, and he got any worries? He said, no, we're fine. That's encouraging. He said, but I've got a question for you. Here we go. And he said, when are we going, sir? When? A week, 10 days, depends on the politicians, but that's my judgment. And many of you will have been exposed to vision statements and mission statements and performance indicators and a lot of commercial management speak, which is people try and impose on defence, and it doesn't really work in my view. But here came the best mission statement I've ever heard in my life. I couldn't get anywhere near it myself. Because he said, here we go. What we've got to do is get across that border, kick that bugger's ass, get home and have a few beers. Beautifully said and done, in my view. There we are, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much.